Thank you. 1977 was a year when America changed its focus. After years of political turmoil and social unrest, Jimmy Carter was inaugurated president in January. America closed the book on things like Watergate and the Vietnam War and instead began to worry about things like inflation and gasoline supplies. Summer began with a story that took place a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away and ended when Elvis Presley was laid to rest. In between, New York City was terrorized by a crazed gunman calling himself the Son of Sam and spent one very long night in pitch darkness. The New York Yankees won their 21st World Series in 1977, and the Minnesota Vikings lost their fourth Super Bowl. A company called Oracle was incorporated in June in Redwood Shores, California, mere months after another company called Apple had been founded just a few miles south. And back in New York City, the world's most famous nightclub, Studio 54, which unveiled its velvet rope in April, was redefining the words elite, exclusive, and excess. The year was marked by the release of four of the 15 best-selling albums of all time, and saw the rise and peak of some of the most iconic bands and performers of the 20th century. It was the year Led Zeppelin played its final concert in America, and the year Leonard Skinner's airplane crashed into a swamp in Mississippi. It was also the year of debut albums by bands like Talking Heads, The Clash, and Motorhead. And while disco ruled the day as the most popular form of music in America, disgruntled teenagers in England put safety pins through their cheeks and started dancing to a very different kind of beat. It was an eclectic year of joy and anger, relief and release. The charts were filled with R&B, funk, disco, southern rock, punk rock, soft rock, Southern California groove rock, Louisiana country, and New York jazz rock fusion. The music was performed by long-established veterans, fresh-faced singer-songwriters, record company in-studio constructs, kids who had just learned how to play guitar, meticulous musicians, and a couple of bombastic bands who were as much about the spectacle as they were about the music itself. In short, 1977 was one of the most important years for music in the 20th century. My name is Rich Larson. This is The Weekly List. Well, good evening, everybody. You're listening to 95.1 KYMN Radio in beautiful downtown Northfield, Minnesota. Thank you for joining us once again on another edition of The Weekly List. I have been promising this show for quite a while. Every time some song would come up from 1977, I would talk about how I think it's possibly the greatest year for music in my lifetime. So when I was casting about trying to find a topic for this week, I came across two fairly important milestones. The first is this week on April 26th, it was the anniversary of Studio 54 opening in 1977. The other thing that caught my eye was the album charts. Fleetwood Mac and the Eagles were in this bare knuckle cage match in April of 1977 for the number one spot on the charts. And this week, Hotel California overtook Rumors as the number one album in the country and would actually go on to spend 8 non-consecutive weeks at number one. Rumors would come back and spend 32 weeks non-consecutively at number one throughout the year. But that's conversation for later in the show. The other thing about this, my cousin Walter published a playlist on Spotify trying to identify the most influential songs from every year of his life. I attempted the same thing and got completely lost when I got to 1977. It just felt like the universe was pushing me this way. So here we are. Let's talk about 1977. First song we heard tonight was Deacon Blues by Steely Dan off their Asia album, which was released September 23rd, 1977. Steely Dan in 1977 they were sort of the smartest band in the room. Donald Fagen and Walter Becker, had, the band had been evolving through most of the decade from a clean sounding, not quite pop rock band to just this immaculately produced jazz rock combo that would employ complicated chord changes and rhythms, and where every note was measured and accounted for and every drum beat was exactly planned and perfectly placed. There was a precision to this music that had not been heard before in rock and roll. And it required the best session players and the best jazz musicians in the world. To wit, Deacon Blues features both Larry Carlton and Lee Ritenour, two of the finest jazz guitar players of their generation, along with session ace Dean Parks to sort of give those two guys a foundation to do, you know, weave their magic. And then the sax solo was played by a guy named Pete Kreisleib, who was a member of Doc Severinsen's band on The Tonight Show. But Kreisleib was, and still is, a very highly respected bebop and West Coast jazz player. And that's what he played on Deacon Blues. Took him exactly two takes to get it right. Next up is the great Stevie Wonder, who by 1977 was riding the crest of an amazing second wave in his career. Beginning in the early 70s, Stevie had shifted his focus from writing hit singles to creating albums that incorporated, you know, a lot of new technology and a lot of new ideas. And lyrically, he wanted to focus on social topics as well as the occasional love song. The result with this was this string of albums that's just, I mean, it's jaw-dropping. Talking Book in 1972, Inner Visions in 1973, Fulfillingness's first finale in 1974, and then Songs in the Key of Life at the end of 1976. And that's not bad. That's a nice run. That ain't bad. This song from Songs in the Key of Life is an homage to a number of Wonder's great heroes, but especially to Duke Ellington, who had passed away just as Stevie was starting to work on Songs in the Key of Life. It was a number one hit in May of 1977. Here's Stevie Wonder with Sir Duke, a 95.1 KYMN, The Rock.
Yeah.
That was the Eagles with Life in the Fast Lane from their all-time classic album, Hotel California. Hotel California was the first Eagles album to feature Joe Walsh, who had joined the band after the departure of founding member Bernie Ledden. Life in the Fast Lane was a song that came from Walsh. He was just improvising that opening riff one day when, you know, Don Henley just snapped his head around and so what the hell was that? We have to make that a song. And then, you know, he and Glenn Frey sat down and wrote the lyrics, and Frey contributed the title after a conversation he had with a drug dealer friend of his. Hotel California was released in December 1976, and because of the fiscal year in the music business, it officially makes it a 1977 album, which I know it's weird. Anyway, the album sold 6 million copies in its first year of release, which by any normal year would have made it the top selling album of the year. 1977, however, was anything but a normal year. 2 months after Hotel California was released on February 4th, 1977, Fleetwood Mac released Rumors. Now, we've talked about that album a lot on this show and, you know, talked about all the dysfunction and the chaos and drugs and betrayals and, you know, people breaking up and sleeping with other people and all that stuff happening within that band, while they were making Rumors. What we haven't really touched on, is the fact that Rumors was this wildfire success that went straight to the top of the charts and based on the strength of three just mammoth hit singles, would have stayed there for the entire year, if not for Hotel California and a certain movie soundtrack album that we're going to get to a little bit later in the show. But for the first part of that year, the number one album in the country was either Hotel California or Rumors. Hotel California has now sold 32 million albums. Rumors has sold 40 million albums. The two albums, I mean, these two albums just, they tapped into something in the mid to late 70s that a lot of people really related to. It's the, you know, from the disillusion that you have in songs like Go Your Own Way and Wasted Time to the sort of drug-induced haze of a song like Gold Dust Woman and, you know, Life in the Fast Lane. British music critic Andy Gill once wrote of the two albums that they, quote, represent the high watermark of America's 70s rock culture expansion. They are the quintessence of countercultural mindset lured into coke-fueled hedonism, unquote. Yeah, that's about right. You know, I think personally, the thing that puts Rumors maybe just slightly over the top of Hotel California, at least in terms of popularity, is Christine McVie. While Lindsey Buckingham and Stevie Nicks and Don Henley and Glenn Frey were all writing about some pretty downer topics, Christine McVie, who herself had been going through a divorce and you know, some pretty tough emotional times, came up with one of the most optimistic anthems that you're ever going to hear. And I think that's probably what sets Rumors apart. Here's Fleetwood Mac with Don't Stop on 95.1 KYMN.
Don't stop thinking about tomorrow. I got what it takes. She said, I'll turn you on the sun into something strong. Play the song with the foggy break. And go kart Mozart was checking out the weather chart to see if it was safe outside. And little early birdie came by in his curly whirly and asked me if I needed a down, but you never got touch. She's gonna make it to the night. She's gonna make it through.
Rebecca, let me crash to the ground. Now Scott with a slingshot,
That was Manfred Mann's Earth Band with their classic cover of Bruce Springsteen's Blinded by the Light, which, interestingly enough, is the only Bruce Springsteen song that's ever hit number one in America. That version of that song. Springsteen himself has never had a number one. The song originally appeared on Springsteen's debut album, Greetings from Asbury Park, New Jersey. And the cover was such a big hit for Manfred Mann that he recorded Spirits in the Night for his next album. And he actually had a pretty good hit with For You on his 1980 album, Chance. Both of those songs obviously were both from Greetings from Asbury Park as well. And I mean, one has to wonder what Manfred Mann could have done if he'd bought Bruce's second album and heard Rosalita. Sorry. Moving on. We need to head over to Berlin for a few minutes to talk about what was going on with David Bowie in 1977. In 1976, David Bowie was facing a dip in his commercial success, and he was beginning to worry about his health and about his sanity while he was immersed in the drug culture of L.A. So he picked up with his new pal Iggy Pop, and they moved to West Berlin. Bowie had become enamored with the techno music scene that was emerging over there, bands like Kraftwerk and Tangerine Dream. And he also enjoyed a certain amount of anonymity over there, which he really liked. He said that he could just be left alone in Berlin. Not that the Germans didn't know who he was, but it was more like, quote, they didn't care, unquote. While he was over there, he worked with producers Tony Visconti and Brian Eno on three albums that are now referred to as, creatively, the Berlin Trilogy. Eno had been brought on board because he understood how to use keyboards and synthesizers to construct soundscapes, while Visconti had been a career-long collaborator of Bowie's, who was really, for these albums at least, more of a sound engineer, and he was sort of a go-between to bridge any communication issues between Bowie and Eno. The first of the three albums, Low, came out in January of 1977 and was met with mixed reactions. Bowie had made another change in music style, embracing that German techno thing, and critics felt like the results were okay, if not great. So, Bowie being Bowie, doubled down, made another album with the same crew in a studio next to the Berlin Wall. So one night during production, Bowie happened to look out the window to see Visconti, who was, well, he was making out with one of the backup singers, up against the Berlin Wall. The juxtaposition of two people making that romantic connection at this, landmark of sheer tyranny was a beautiful thing to David Bowie. So he sat down and he wrote the lyrics to Heroes, which became the title track of his second album to be released that year and is now considered to be really one of his finest moments. From October of 1977, here's David Bowie with Heroes on 95.1 KYMN.
Drive them away. say.
Really means a lot.
Bee Gees with How Deep Is Your Love from the Saturday Night Fever soundtrack. More than any album, including Rumors and Hotel California, and for that matter, Bat Out of Hell, which, depending on who you talk to, is the fourth of the four top 15 of all time albums that was released in 1977, and actually is in fact the third best selling album of all time with 50 million albums sold. I digress. More than any other album released in 1977, the soundtrack to the film Saturday Night Fever defines the era. It is probably the, well, it is. It's not even probably. It's the finest collection of disco music you will ever find, offering five original Bee Gees songs, each one of them you know, including the most famous disco song of them all, Staying Alive. It's got Casey and the Sunshine Band with Boogie Shoes. It's got Disco Inferno by the Tramps. If I Can't Have You by Yvonne Elliman. I mean, it's 90 minutes of mirrored lit balls and butterfly collars and platform shoes. Now, you know, like we said in the intro, America had changed its focus by 1977. People were tired of social unrest, and they very clearly, they just wanted a party. They also wanted to watch John Travolta dance, evidently, and Saturday Night Fever certainly afforded them that opportunity. The movie was released on December 16th, 1977. It was made for $3.5 million and went on to gross $237 million worldwide. It made Travolta a superstar and created some of the most iconic imagery of the 1970s with the lit disco floors and the white three-piece suits. I say what you will about disco, it was the right thing at the right time for a country that had been through the ringer for about 10 years. It was time to blow off some steam, and that four on the floor beat and those dramatic string arrangements and those falsetto vocals, it provided the way to do it. So, okay, it's time for your update on what's happening at Imminent Brewing this week. As always, I want to thank Imminent for sponsoring the weekly list. For those of you who do not know, Imminent is considered an essential business during the stay-at-home order because they have an off-sale liquor license. Off-sale, of course, means that they can sell you beer to take off-site and drink at home. All of their beer is available right now in 64-ounce growlers and 750-milliliter howlers. As I'm recording this, it sounds like Governor Walz is getting ready to ease up on a lot of those stay-at-home restrictions. I don't know what that means for bars and restaurants, but I can tell you that the Imminent Brewing management has made the decision to not open the tap room until at least mid-May, and that's if they're allowed to at all. It might still be a long time, or it might be sooner than you think. We don't know right now. Just know that Imminent is committed to caring for the health and the well-being of both its customers and its staff. So they're just trying to stay safe. So for now, the tap room is going to remain closed. With that said, they do want to make it easy for you to get, as easy for you to get their beers as possible within, you know, within the law, of course. To that end, you can order beer online through their website at imminentbrewing.com. Just go to the website and click on the box that talks about ordering. It's all pretty simple and straightforward. When you go to pick it up, if you don't want to go inside, you can just give them a call. They'll bring it out to you. You don't have to get out of your car, or you do have to get out of your car, I should say, because state law does not allow them to sell you beer while you're seated in a motor vehicle. Also, you do need to be prepared to show your ID and prove that you're at least 21 years of age. They will have food trucks there this weekend. Deep Roots Concessions will be there on Friday. Medbox is bringing their Euro Magic down from the cities on Saturday. And on Sunday, it's Potter's Pasties. And then next Thursday, Norris Cuisine is scheduled to be there. Right now, Imminent is open Tuesday through Sunday. Tuesday through Friday, their hours are 4 to 7 p.m. And Saturday and Sunday, they're open 2 to 7. Obviously, they would love to have the tap room open to the public, but for now, those are just the standard hours. If you want any more information, give them a call at 507-646-2327 or visit the imminentbrewing.com website. We touched on some of the debut albums that were released in 1977, but failed to mention My Aim Is True by Elvis Costello, because the whole thing is a little bit shaky. But in 1977, Elvis Costello, whose real name is Declan McManus, was a brash and driven 23-year-old kid from London who had borrowed part of his name and part of his image from early American rock and roll legends. His debut album, My Aim Is True, was produced by another British pub rock upstart named Nick Lowe, and it was recorded in 4 6-hour sessions. So in 24 hours, they recorded the whole album. The album initially fizzled in England and wasn't even released in America. But Costello he toured relentlessly, doing whatever he could to make a name for himself. He even got arrested for busking outside of a CBS Records CBS Records executives. He was just trying to, you know, get some attention in front of some people that might give him a break. I don't know. His big breakthrough actually may well have come the night he filled in for the Sex Pistols on Saturday Night Live. We talked about this story a month or so ago, but he had been touring clubs in the States when the Sex Pistols had to cancel their appearance on SNL at the last minute because the U.S. government wouldn't issue the band the visa they needed. And so Malcolm McLaren, who was the Sex Pistols manager, recommended Elvis Costello, and they said, okay, fine, we'll book him. And then during the broadcast, he caused an uproar when he started playing one song, only to stop his band a few measures in and played a completely different song that had not been cleared by NBC. He was banned from SNL for more than 20 years, but, you know, at least he got his name in the paper. The next year, he released This Year's Model, which became a big hit, and shortly thereafter, My Aim Is True was released in America, finally. You know, for all of that, My Aim Is True is an amazing album. It's got songs like, you know, Less Than Zero and Welcome to the Working Week and The Angels Want to Wear My Red Shoes and this one, which one might assume would be one of the biggest hits of Elvis Costello's career. But in truth, it never even made a dent in the American charts. From 1977, this is Elvis Costello with Allison on 95.1 KYMN, The One.
Oh, it's so funny to be seeing you after so long, girl. And with the way you look, I understand that you were not impressed. But I heard you let that little friend of mine take off your party dress. I'm not gonna get too sentimental like those other sticker valentines, 'cause I don't know if you are loving somebody. I only know it isn't mine. Allison, I know this world is killing. Lying in the wedding cake, you used to hold him right in your hand. I bet it took all he could take. Sometimes I wish that I could stop you from talking when I hear the silly things that you say. I think somebody better put out the big light, 'cause I can't stand to see you this way. Allison, I know this world is killing you. Oh, Allison, my aim is true. My
I don't wanna wait.
was a song called Waiting in Vain by Bob Marley and the Wailers, which was on an album called Exodus that came out in June of 1977. Someday we're going to do a Bob Marley show because it's just, I mean, there's really no way you can sum up what Bob Marley meant to millions of people around the world in, you know, 2.5 minutes. Or I mean, I don't even know if I'll be able to do an entire show, but... You know, as a musician, as a man of peace, as a shaman, there aren't a lot of guys out there who compare to Bob Marley. This was a man who was from one of the poorest sections of one of the poorest countries in the entire world, Jamaica. And he found himself wielding global influence, because of his philosophy. And he did it with the grace and the dignity and the aplomb of some of history's greatest leaders. Bob Marley was a miracle. And that's why it's so jarring to hear some of the stories about the making of Exodus, in particular, in the heat of a deeply and tightly contested election season in Jamaica, somebody tried to assassinate Bob Marley. He survived the attempt. But he was wounded, along with his wife Rita and his manager. It sent Marley into exile in England, where he finished recording Exodus. Exodus is considered by many to be Marley's best work. There's the title track, One Love, Jamming, Three Little Birds, Waiting in Vain. I mean, it's just an amazing album. Incidentally, about a month after Exodus was released, Marley was diagnosed with a malignant form of skin cancer that would eventually take his life. But that's a story for another day. Next up is Scenes from an Italian Restaurant by Billy Joel off of his career breakthrough album, The Stranger. Beginning in 1977, Billy Joel was a journeyman singer-songwriter. He had a regional following in the New York City area, but not much outside of that. He'd made 4 very good albums, but had no real radio success at all. And then one night he played a concert at Carnegie Hall that was attended by producer Phil Ramone. Ramone had worked with John Coltrane, Ray Charles, the band, Bob Dylan, and pretty much everybody else. And he approached Billy Joel after the concert and offered to produce his next album. Now, Billy Joel was skeptical of music people at this point in his career, and really felt like part of the reason his earlier albums hadn't met with more success was because he had been forced to use session musicians that had been handpicked by the previous album's producers and was not allowed to use his own band on the records. Ramone was a highly respected and highly successful producer, keep in mind, but he agreed. He wanted to produce Billy Joel that much. He said, okay, I'm going to let you use your live band. And the process resulted in not just one great album, but it was the blueprint for a string of smash hit albums that would extend really until the end of Billy Joel's recording career in 1993. Scenes from an Italian Restaurant was almost, well, it was. I mean, it was obviously, it was 3 different half-finished songs that were all strung together. Billy Joel had been a fan of the Beatles since he saw them perform on the Ed Sullivan Show in February of 1964. And he was enamored with the second side of Abbey Road, which is where producer George Martin had helped John Lennon and Paul McCartney string several unfinished songs together to form a medley that really became the band's, like, you know, final momentous creative statement. So Phil Ramone helped Billy Joel do the same thing with Scenes from an Italian Restaurant. The idea is that as the song progresses, you sort of float from table to table and you get a feel for the stories and the people that are sitting in the restaurant. And that opening line, bottle of white, bottle of red, actually came from a waiter who was serving Billy Joel at a restaurant across the street from Carnegie Hall. To this day, he says it's one of the best songs he ever wrote. So from 1977, from The Stranger, here's Billy Joel with Scenes from an Italian Restaurant, a 95.1 KYMN, the one.
A bottle of white, a bottle of red, perhaps a bottle of rosé instead. Get a table near the street in our old familiar place, you and I face to face. A bottle of red, a bottle of white, it all depends upon your appetite. I'll meet you anytime you want our Italian restaurant.
Thank you.
but you can never go back there again. No. '75, from the height of the low to the end of the show for the rest of their lives. You couldn't go back to the greasers. Best they could do was pick up their pieces. We always knew they would both find a way to get by. Oh, and that's all I heard about Brenda Renee. Can't tell you more because I told you already.
That was the aforementioned Sex Pistols with God Save the Queen. If you're going to do a show about the music in 1977, you have to talk about punk rock. And if you're going to talk about punk rock, then you have to talk about the Sex Pistols, who released their debut album, Nevermind the Bollocks, Here's the Sex Pistols, that year. And if you're going to pick one specific Sex Pistols song to play for 1977, it has to be God Save the Queen, which is a toss-off at Queen Elizabeth and the British Monarchy. 1977 was the year of Queen Elizabeth's Silver Jubilee, meaning she was celebrating 25 years as the Queen, 25 years on the throne. On the day of the anniversary of her coronation, the band chartered a boat to take them down the River Thames while they played God Save the Queen in an attempt to disrupt Her Majesty's anniversary ceremony. Things didn't go quite the way they had been planned. Fight broke out on the boat, and instead of disrupting the Queen's Silver Jubilee, the band's manager, Malcolm McLaren, was arrested when the boat docked. That's actually fairly typical of the Sex Pistols. Great ideas, poor execution. Ever get the feeling you've been cheated? Well, folks, that's going to just about do it for this edition of the Weekly List. If you like the show and you want to hear more, you can visit our program page on the KYMN website at kymnradio.net, or you can go find our Facebook page under the Weekly List, where I post every new show every Friday morning. You should also go like the KYMN Facebook page. You know, as a lot of you are returning to Facebook during the lockdown, KYMN is an important place for you to go and pay attention. Jeff Johnson and Terry Knight are working like mad to keep us all updated on what's going on with school and the hospital and local government, local business. It's the best source in my mind for all of your, you know, Rice County area, Northfield area, local news. And everything they do, all those interviews, all those stories, they land on that Facebook page. So give them a like. And also, I failed to mention, I should have talked about this before, go like the Imminent Facebook page as well. Imminent is starting to host some online concerts on their Facebook page, featuring a lot of people who have played at Imminent in the past, and really just some of the best, really, I mean, some of the best talent that, that Minnesota has to offer. Thank you very much. And you know, as these shows are announced, you know, you'll be able to watch them. You'll know about them. You won't be caught off guard when you hear about it later. So go like the Imminent Brewing Facebook page. We're going to leave you tonight with a double single from Queen. They released their News of the World album in 1977. And it included a piece of music that is, it's just got to be the most ubiquitous thing in all of sports. In every stadium across the world, if you go to a game, you will hear this music. You know this song. You love this song. And who doesn't love singing "We Will Rock You" after their favorite football team has taken a 12-point lead on the Green Bay Packers? Thanks for listening, everybody. This was a fun show to do, and I hope you enjoyed it. We'll talk to you guys again next week. Peace.
Buddy, you're a boy, make a big noise, playing in the street, gonna be a big man someday. You got mud on your face, you big disgrace, kicking your can all over the place, singing, we will rock you. A big disgrace, waving your banner all over the place.
We will rock you.
Sing it!
We will rock you.
Buddy, you're an old man, poor man, pleading with your eyes, gonna make you zombie someday. You got mud on your face, big disgrace. Somebody better put your bag into your place.
We will rock you.
Sing it.
We will
life sentence, but committed no crime. And bad mistakes, I've made a few. I've had my share of bad kicks in my face, but I come through.
And I need to go home.
My friend.